Hey guys, my name is Joe. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 7th of 2002, and I have a home group and I have a sponsor. And thank you for asking me to join you guys. I've never been here before, but I've gotten to know some of you who've come up and spoke at my home group, and it is it's nice to travel in AA. I came down with a guy I sponsor and a woman that my girlfriend actually sponsors. And I don't know why I thought this meeting was right outside of Richmond. But Rouge is moving to Richmond in like 4 weeks. So I was like, oh, cool. We'll come down and she'll meet some people in Richmond. And then we turned off 95 and I was like, this is not Richmond. So, yep, but we're here. And if you don't get anything else out of what I say tonight, all I can tell you is that Alcoholics Anonymous works. You know, and the best way I've heard it described recently is from a friend of mine who said, I am incapable of the circumstances of my life without Alcoholics Anonymous. Plain and simple. There's nothing else that needs to be added to that. Everything good and decent in my life is a direct result of the actions I've been told to take in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, whether that be with my career or financial or with relationships or with my family or whatever it may be, it's all centered around Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And that's worked. And I'm trying not to be an original thinker in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because there aren't a lot of original thinkers in AA. Unfortunately, well, that's just how it goes. But I'm going to tell you guys in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And excuse me. We're going to laugh. We're going to cry. We're going to have a good time. And so I was 14 years old when I took my first drink. I was with some friends on a humid May night in the eighth grade. And we raided the liquor cabinet and grabbed a bunch of gin, peach schnapps, rum, vodka, probably some whiskey and some orange juice, put it in a big old tumbler, started passing it around. And it came to me, and it burned. It burned in my mouth, burned in my throat, burned in my stomach. There was nothing enjoyable about that. But I went into the fridge, and I grabbed a Sam Adams Boston Lager. And it was humid that night, so there was condensation on the outside of the bottle. The paper still has that crisp paper feeling against the cold, condensated bottle. And then you twist off the top and the mist comes out of the top. And then it touches your lips and it rolls down and my life changed right there. And I said in that moment to my friends, I'm going to do this as often as I can for the rest of my life. And beer and me were just like, match made in heaven. You know? I early on in my life, I had everything I could want, you know, I really did. And I had gotten into this private school in downtown D.C., this all-boys Catholic school where my older brothers had gone. And people knew my name, and I liked the attention. And I was playing football, and just all these ego-fulfilling things. Like, I had the right friends. I lived in the right neighborhood. I wore the right clothes. I dated, you know, a girl that wore the plaid skirt and knee-high socks. It was like, you know, at 14, 15 years old, you can't ask for much more, you know. And I loved it, and I relished in it, and I partied in it, you know. And my brother was a senior when I was a freshman, and his friends would take me from a school dance and get me drunk and shave my head and drop me off on my parents' doorstep at 3 in the morning, hammered. And I loved it. I had a lot of fun, you know. And then I got this job between my freshman and sophomore year of high school working at a golf course. And in the golf industry, they don't care what you do as long as you're there when you're supposed to be, you know. And I'm working with this guy who's like 22, 23. And he comes up to me early in the summer, and he's like, hey, I like to drink Evan Williams whiskey. And if you give me $5 on Monday, I'll go buy a handle of Evan Williams and leave it in the shack. And you drink as much as you want throughout the week, and on Monday give me $5 and drink as much as you want. And I said, I have $5. I would love to do that with you. You know, and I started drinking Evan Williams whiskey, you know. Some days we'd start at 11, some days we'd wait till 3 or 4, you know. Didn't really matter. But then, you know, here I am driving this golf cart, crashing into trees, running over greens, destroying flags, and just like, just blitzed at 15, right? And then near the end of the summer, I decided to do some, you know, some other stuff with a friend of mine before going to see a movie one night. And we're in the woods, and this guy comes out of the woods, essentially, with a gun pointed right in our face and just says, "Freeze." I was like, oh, thank God. I'm being arrested, not robbed, right? So I'm like, okay. You know, so I got arrested for the first time when I was 15. And, you know, I told my parents, this happens to everyone, you know. It's not a big deal. I was just, you know, going to see a movie with some friends. We thought it'd be more fun, you know. And this is like the last weekend of summer. And then the first weekend of school started, and I got caught drinking at a school dance. And my parents grounded me. And I don't say that because it's like such a great consequence. But something happened to me somewhere around in that time. I couldn't tell you what night it was. But I remember that I was staring at the ceiling trying to fall asleep, and I can't. So I think if I just go outside and smoke a cigarette and calm my nerves down, I could fall asleep. And I smoked 3 or 4 cigarettes, and now it's 2:30 in the morning. I'm still staring at the ceiling, and I can't fall asleep. And all of a sudden, I start to see spots. And then all of a sudden, I'm shaking, and I'm sweating, and it feels like ants are crawling all under my skin. And I can't calm down my nerves enough to just fall asleep. And it dawned on me, if I could just take a drink, maybe I could calm down my nerves. And I come to find out that I was in alcohol withdrawal. You know, I was drinking 5-6 days a week all summer. You know, I was 15, and I had no idea what was happening at that point to me. And I don't think you'd be surprised to find out that there was a lot more consequences coming down the road for me. I wound up getting kicked out of that high school for my grades, you know, because I was into all the other stuff, you know. And then when I left that private school, I started going back to public school with all my friends I had grown up with. And my mom was a well-liked and respected math teacher at the junior high across the street. And my mom had taught every kid in the school, and my mom had taught all the teachers' kids and taught the principal's kid. And so everyone knew me as Mrs. Sweeney's son. And so I just took advantage of that, and I really just kind of gave up on doing anything that I was supposed to in life. Like, I was not interested in going to class and doing homework or, like, studying. I had no interest. I wanted to go out and do what I was going to do with my friends, you know, and that was drinking or whatever I could get my hands on. And the one night, a friend of mine bet me I couldn't knock him out with one punch. So I broke my hand on his forehead, and I had to have reconstructive surgery on my hand. And I'm drunk. I'm in the ER, and the doctor is like, what happened? I said, well, I slammed my hand in the car door. And he said, you got a boxer's fracture from slamming your hand in a car door? I said, mm-hmm. He goes, you're going to stick to that? I was like, yep. He's like, all right. So, you know, then 2 weeks after that, I got caught smoking cigarettes at school, and they're going to suspend me. And I've been sitting in the office for like 3 hours, and I was like, you know what, I'm leaving. So I just got up to leave, and one of the security guards grabbed me from behind, and I swung my cast at this poor woman, and thank God I missed her, because that would have been really bad. And but my point is that I wound up getting suspended for 15 days for that, and I was a smartass and told them all what I thought, and I just didn't see a point of going back to school after that, so I dropped out. And my brain came up with a solution. Now, in our third chapter, it lists – where are we? Where am I? Sorry, whatever. It's in the third chapter. There's 19 things we do to try and stop drinking. I'm going to, with and without a solemn oath, we're never going to drink alone. We're not going to drink at work. you know, whatever it may be, you know, more exercise. And I did a geographic. I thought if I moved to California, I could stop doing drugs and drinking. Well, I was able to stop one of them. But I drank four times while I lived in California. And every time I drank, something stupid would happen. I'd get into a fight with my brother. I'd be late for work. I'd fall flat on my face and break my nose. It's just like there was no longer consequence-free drinking. There was no longer a fun party drinking at this point. Something had evolved in my drinking and in my life and how I felt. That it was no longer fun like it had been. And now I don't know why I'm taking a drink, but part of me is like looking back on it, I'm like, I'm hoping it'll be fun this time. You know? I come back from California for my birthday in May, and I take a piss test to prove to my parents that I was clean. And then I was drunk and, you know, high with the same friends in the same basements later that night. That was in May, and then in July, I was locked in a psych ward in Northern Virginia watching the fireworks go off on July 4th through a plate glass window thinking, how did I get here? How'd this happen? I was 17 years old, and I still had an answer. My brain still had solutions, you know, and when my brain comes up with an idea, I need to try it to hell and back before I'm willing to do anything that you suggest of me, you know, because that's just the way I am. And I thought boarding school is the answer this time. So my parents sent me to a boarding school. I have parents that I don't deserve. And it's great because boarding school is essentially an institution where they do everything for you. They wake you up. They do your laundry. They cook all your meals. They tell you when to go to class. They tell you when to go to study hall. They will tell you when to do everything. And I thought, I'm playing football again. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. This is good. And I'm a great starter. For 3 weeks, I killed it at boarding school. Then week four comes and I just get that itch, you know. I go to my roommate's hometown in Pennsylvania for a weekend, and you know what happens there. And, you know, then I come back, and now I've got I've woken the beast up again, you know, with taking a drink that weekend. And so now I need to find alcohol in the middle of Coloral County, Maryland, where there's more horses than people. And I'm like, well, what do I do? So you start breaking into teachers' houses, right? That's where alcohol is. You go find it, right? And then I was telling this story in the car earlier. One Friday night, I'm playing football, and there's a kickoff, and I'm returning the kick. And it bounces short and hits one of my teammates, so it's a fumble. And I run headfirst after this ball, and I dive. And I went forehead to forehead with a guy who had his feet on the ground. And my feet came up and hit me in the back of the head. And all of a sudden, everything from like my chest down goes numb. And they bring the helicopter onto the field. They take me to shock trauma in Baltimore. And I think I've really just paralyzed myself playing football. I think I've just snapped my spinal cord in half. And it's not a pretty sight. I've been to the ER, and when you have like seven or eight people around you, that's not a good sign, you know, and I'm worried. But they hit me with a bunch of stuff, and I just passed out. And I don't know why, but later that day, I walked out of that hospital, and I don't know why, but they gave me a prescription that, you know, that I took with me. And not that, like, that was the problem for the rest of my life, but that was always nearby, you know. And I had these other problems. I picked up habits everywhere and just kind of rotated, or I juggled them, you know, like what's the soup du jour, you know, this week, right? Like that's what we'll do, you know? But ultimately I love to drink, you know, cheap whiskey and beer, you know? There's just something about it, you know? And I got kicked out of that boarding school like 3 weeks later. And I come back to DC on the train, and my uncle picks me up. He says, you've been to three high schools in 2 years. What are you going to do with your life? My brain still has ideas of what will change my life, unfortunately. And I just need to get a job. I need to get a GED. I need to get my own place. I need to get a girlfriend. I need to get a car. And the right combination of materialistic things will make me feel like a normal human being. You know? And I set out to get those things. And I went from like bad job to worst job, you know. I was cutting bagels for a long time. And then I worked at a gas station overnight for like a week. And that was awful. Overnights were terrible for me. Because I'd rather be out drinking. And then I went back to the golf industry. Because, again, no one cares what I'm doing, you know, at 9, 10 in the morning. In – this would have been December of 2000. My parents – again, parents I don't deserve – decided to take the whole family on vacation to St. Thomas in the Caribbean. And on Christmas Day, it is about 78 degrees. We're at Megan's Bay, which is like 400 yards wide, cliffs on both sides, white sandy beach, crystal clear water. It's paradise. It's Christmas. The weather is perfect. I have a Corona with a lime in it, my favorite drink, and I'm surrounded by my family, these people I'm supposed to love. And I'm in that moment, and I'm not happy. And I think to myself, if I can't be happy with this, I can't be happy. Like, this should be it, right? With people I love, my favorite drink in paradise. Why is this not enough? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? Please tell me, you know? They're like, well, Joe, if you stop drinking and doing drugs, you'll be all right. I'm like, well, you don't get it. You don't have what I have. Drinking and drugs aren't my problem. Your expectations or your problems with me and your demands of me and you're asking me to do any, you're asking me to take out the trash, that's my problem, right? You know, if you just let me sit and drink alone by myself, I wouldn't have any problems. It's your BS is the problem, you know? And on Christmas Day, my family asked if, they said, hey, let's go to this other island and see some wild animals. And I said, no, I'm good. And I went into the hotel room and I just got drunk on a case of beer by myself while my family went to some other island on Christmas. And that was, you know, and that wasn't even a big deal at the time, you know. I'll tell this. All right. So the same trip, we were all packed in this rental car. It's me, my mom, my dad, and my three brothers. And we're stopped at a red light and I'm sitting in shotgun in this little car, and I'm looking up at this lady in a sport utility. And she says, why don't you put your seatbelt on? And I said, why don't you mind your own effing business, right? This is how I treated people. And she said, uh-huh. And then she turned on the lights on top of her squad car. Couldn't see the lights from my angle. And, you know, this is just like my luck, right? Like, how does this happen? And she pulled my dad out of the car, gave him a tongue lashing, and he just got back in the car and said, well, do we need to talk about this, or are we good? And I was like, we're good. You know? Like, I knew I messed up. But that was my attitude. You know, I was not a nice person. I used to say that alcohol would let me go talk to that girl or punch that guy. You know? It gave me the ability to be who I wanted to be. And it took away all my fears, you know, it took it all away so I could be who I wanted to be or who I thought you wanted me to be, you know, wherever, however I could fit in. And, in March of 2002, one of my best friends was pledging a fraternity at the University of Maryland, and he tried to drink a handle of vodka one night, and, he went into a back bedroom and he passed out. And he never woke up again. 3 days later, his dad and his brother pulled him off of the ventilator, and Dan wound up passing away. And Dan and I drank the exact same way, drink for drink, shot for shot. And then at like midnight, Dan would say dumb things like, we should stop, I have to work tomorrow. You know, why would we do that, right? I'm just getting going. I'm just feeling lubricated to life. And it scared me. Because I thought I was next. And I had a couple of experiences right around that time. I couldn't tell you chronologically when they happened. But I was drunk one afternoon. I was backing my car up out of a parking space, and I almost hit a little kid, little girl. Thank God I didn't. I think it was an afternoon. I was driving down Whitehurst Freeway in D.C. towards K Street. And at the end, it jogs to the right, like 20 feet, and there's a Jersey wall right there. Well, I forgot about the Jersey wall at 90 miles an hour with a car full of six of my friends. And we missed that Jersey wall by like 3 or 4 inches. If I had wrapped myself around a telephone pole, I would have been okay with that. I really would have. That would have been the easy way out. But the thought of hitting a van full of a family or running over some little kid drunk, that messed me up. Because I wasn't raised to be that kind of person, but this was a reality of how I was living, you know, the drunk driving and everything else that I was up to. And when Dan died, I had decided I'm going to stop drinking and I'm going to stop doing drugs for the first time in my life. I had said that I now have a sufficient reason to stop. I'm going to do it. And I locked myself in my parents' basement for 4 days, and then I went to Dan's funeral. And funerals are no fun, but funerals for young people are just, they're terrible. And I didn't know how to deal with pain, sadness, fear. I just didn't know how. And the only life skill I had to deal with those things is to take a drink. So I left that funeral and I took a drink. And I woke up the next morning and I said, I'm not going to do that again. Today I'm going to do something different. Today I'm not going to take a drink. Later that night, it's 5:30 in the morning. I'm in the same basement with dog stuff all over the floor. And it's essentially a crack house. They just don't sell crack at this place. But everything else is like right out of a movie. You know, there's blankets over the windows. And I can hear the birds chirping. So it's got to be somewhere around 5:30. You know, the sun's starting to come up. And I go into the bathroom and I look in the mirror. And I'm drunk, and I say, how did this happen? I said, this morning I said I wasn't going to do this. How am I here? You know, how did this happen again? And the next morning I wake up, I say, I'm not going to do that again. Later that night, I'm looking in the mirror again, drunk, saying, how did this happen? And I lived that way for the next 5 months, taking a drink every single day, not wanting to. And I finally made the decision on a Tuesday that on Friday when I got my paycheck, I was going to go to Guns and Trains in Kensington, Maryland. I was going to buy a shotgun because there's no waiting period, and all I needed is one round. And I'm going to blow my head off because every idea my brain could come up with for how to change my life, I had tried and it didn't work. And I had lost hope that anything could ever change. The paranoia, the pain, the depression, the sadness. Taking a drink and it not working for me. Drinking wouldn't shut up my head at the end. It just didn't. It stopped working for me. And I was drinking hoping it would. Every time I took a drink, I just wanted to quiet down. I'm not asking for it to be a fun party like when I was 14, 15 years old. I'm just asking for a little bit of relief from this pain that I'm in and this hopelessness. And I would get it, you know, maybe once every 2 months, maybe. And so on Wednesday, I'd been seeing this therapist. I don't know why my parents were still paying for it, but I told him my plan. Told him what I've been up to, my drinking. And he said, I'm going to blow my head off on Friday. He said, well, why don't you try rehab? You can blow your head off later. Those were his exact words to me. And it floored me. I was like, are you allowed to talk to me like that? Like, what if I actually do it, right? Like, that's a problem. And but I thought, okay, what have I got to lose? I can always blow my head off later. And so I thought I had this original idea. And I went into my parents and I was like, hey, I think I want to go to rehab. And they're like, cool, it's called Clearbrook. It's in Pennsylvania, right outside of Wilkesboro. You know? And I was like, wait a minute, what? You know? I was the last one to know. But at that point, I had been blacking out, browning out. I had been violent to people around me. My friends were done with me. My phone didn't ring. No one wanted to spend time with me. My family, my parents were kicking me out of the house because I had come home one day and I'd punched my little brother as hard as I could, stepped over his crying body, went into his bedroom and grabbed his toys and went off to the pawn shop. And my dad was like, I can't have you around your little brother. He's like in the seventh grade, you know, like you're now violent towards us. And so they were kicking me out, and my two older brothers wouldn't speak to me. My little brother would flinch around me because of that incident, you know, and I agreed with all these people, you know. So I went up to this rehab up in Pennsylvania, and you know, I was so different from everyone there, you know. A lot of people struggled with, you know, with their things they struggled with that I just, and you know, that wasn't what we were doing in the crowd I hung out with, you know. And there's a different part of the country, and you know, it was just like my outsides and their outsides didn't match. And at that point, that was a big deal to me, you know, because I was all about ego and image, because that's literally the only thing I could hold on to, because I had zero substance as a human being, you know. And and while I was there, I read the doctor's opinion, and then I read to the third chapter, like I talked about tonight, and I read those 19 things we try to do to stop drinking, and I've tried 18 of them. And I got scared, and I put it down, and I didn't pick the book back up while I was there. But the second week I was in that rehab, they had given me the contact information for this gentleman named Russ. And Russ had sponsored this guy, Travis, at one point. Travis was a young guy, and Russ was, you know, probably 70s, in the 70s at the time. And I called Russ, and I talked to him, you know, they're like, get a contact with someone in your area so you can get to a meeting when you get out. And I was like, okay. But Russ said, hey, Joe, I want you to put you in contact with this guy, Travis. And I sponsored Travis for 5 years, and he'd been in and out of the rooms. And then he went to jail for 2 years, and he got out. And he's got 3 years sober now with this young people's group. And he's been able to stay sober. So why don't you give Travis a call? And this is in 2001, before a lot of people had cell phones. And Travis didn't have a cell phone, but he had a car. And he would leave the meeting at 9:31 and drive home to be at the phone at 10 o'clock at night so he could take my phone call 3 times a week. And I didn't know that's what he was doing. And he never met me. He didn't know me. And he just talked to me. And he listened to me, and he shared his experience with me. And he talked to me for an hour, 45 minutes. 2-3 times a week. And he made a plan for me my first night out of rehab on a Saturday. And it was October 5th of 2002, Saturday night. And he said, I'm going to have one of my roommates come pick you up because I'm going to be in New York with a friend of mine, with his girlfriend. And so I got out of rehab, and I had a plan before I ever left. And I got taken to this meeting, and I met you guys. And at that meeting, I could relate to the words you were saying, because you had the vocabulary to describe how I felt that I had never heard before in my life. I had never heard restless, irritable, and discontent. But you didn't have to explain it to me. And you talk about the relief that comes from taking a few drinks. You didn't have to explain that to me. One guy even talked about getting relief on the way to the liquor store, not even having taken a drink yet. And I was like, oh, I've got that. So for the first time in my life, I didn't feel like I was an alien that was just straight up broken. I didn't. Because no one, maybe they had, I just never heard it. You know, I had talked about alcoholism and the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And I've got the allergy of the body. There was one time in my life where I had the opportunity to drink, and I didn't. Once. In 6.5 years of drinking. Like, I can't argue with those statistics, right? And then the hard part was is that I couldn't understand the people that were standing in front of me. you had this, like, the edges of your mouth, like, curled in an upward arc, and it was weird, right? And then you did this thing when something was funny, you would, like, laugh, and nothing had been funny for months. Where I came from, that dark space, there was nothing funny. And you were like, there's that light in the eyes of someone that's awake in Alcoholics Anonymous that I couldn't understand. How can you guys talk about my drinking like no one ever has, but now you look like this? And you are no longer suffering from alcoholism. That's obvious. But I am. And I raised my hand in that first meeting. I said, my name is Joe. I'm an alcoholic. I just got out of rehab tonight, and I'm afraid I'm going to get drunk. Can you please help me? And I got surrounded after the meeting. Everyone wants my phone number. Everyone wants to talk to me. And this guy, I knew, I had gone to high school with his little brother. And his name was Drew. And Drew said, what are you doing tonight? I said, well, I'm going to go home and rent a movie from Blockbuster, right? So most of you know Blockbuster, you know. Like, sometimes I have to explain that to a crowd, you know, like what you did at a Blockbuster. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to go rent a movie and have Blockbuster sobriety. That sounds great. And he said, well, some of us are going out to eat, and then we're going to go to a party tonight. Why don't you come with us? Now, I had since gone to that meeting many times. People do not go out to eat after the meeting there. It's from 8 to 9. They've already eaten dinner, but they did that night. And they took me and they all talked to me, five or six men. And after dinner, they said, what are you doing tonight? I'm like, this guy's like, you got something wrong with him. I already told him. I told you I'm going to Blockbuster and then I'm going to go home. He said, well, why don't you come to this party with us? A guy is celebrating a year sober at midnight. And we're going to sing him happy birthday. I was like, all right, what have I got to lose? You know, without even knowing it, I'm already living in the third step. I don't even know it. But that's what's happening. I'm giving my will and my life over to something other than me. And at this party, it's at a house. People are dancing. People are laughing. They're all carrying red Solo cups. It is weird, right? Because there's no keg on the back porch. Everything else looks very similar to me, but this is a strange environment. You know, and I'm nervous as hell. I can't talk to anyone. I'm sweating. My palms are like just melting, right? I'm like, oh my God, please don't make me have to shake anyone's hand, you know, because you're going to judge me. And that's the worst thing that could happen, right, is you judge me. And you know how insecure I am. And if you look at me, I might just die, you know. But I survived that night, and I wound up getting a sponsor that night. I got that guy Drew, and then I wound up changing my sobriety date because I was comfortable with it to that Monday, which was October 7th of 2002. And early on in sobriety, I learned that materialistic things make me feel better, right? So I'm just going to go get a bunch of those and all that God stuff you guys can, whatever. I'm good. I need a girlfriend, not a God. And funny thing, when you do that, she becomes God, and you'll do anything to keep her happy, right? And so I went out, and I got a bunch of good stuff in my sobriety. I moved out of my parents' house. I got a job working with some friends as a camp counselor. I was living with my sponsor, you know, in his house, and I had gotten an attractive girlfriend. And then at 9 months sober, my girlfriend broke up with me on a Wednesday and started dating one of my best friends on a Friday. He had a car. I didn't have a car. And my sponsor, who I was living with, kicked me out because I'm a jerk, and I deserved it. He had zero blame in this. And I'm working this job with her. So I'm around her like 10 hours a day because then I see her at the meetings. And let's just say that life was not going well for me. You know, I did not react well to that scenario. And The following Thursday night, I'm selling literature over at a meeting, you know, trying to hold it together. And in walks my ex higher power with her new boyfriend, and it just throws me down a spiral. And I just go downstairs to the bathroom, and I just start puking my guts out because I can't handle this. And I'm like, if this is sobriety, you can have it, because this pain hurts just as much as when I was drinking. And I feel just as hopeless. And now I still feel like, you know, I'm the aunt and God's the five-year-old with a magnifying glass, right? Just like loving it, you know? This is how I felt. And this guy, Larry O, walked into the bathroom and he said, "What's wrong with you?" And I told him, and he was like, "Oh my God." You know, he was thinking I had a bad day. Like I had had a really bad week, you know? And he said, "Well, you need a God in your life." I said, "That's great, Larry, but I don't believe in God." And Larry said, "Well, do you believe that there's a God working in my life?" And if you ever had the honor and a privilege to get to know Larry O'Connor, you would know that he was one of those few people you meet in life where faith in a God is not a faith. It's an absolute belief and reliance. And it infiltrates absolutely everything they do as a human being. And they carry it with them everywhere. And they don't push it on you, but you can tell that there's something going on with those type of people. You know, and they're the kindest, gentlest people in the world. And Larry was that kind of person. And I said, "Yeah, Larry, I can believe that there's a God working in your life. That's undeniable." He said, "Well, why don't you pray to my God? He's big enough, loving enough, and strong enough to be shared." And I thought, this is a total gimmick. And I know he's just playing a mind trick on me, but I'll give it a shot. And I said, "Okay." Later that night, all the pain of my circumstances comes back. And it's 2 in the morning. I'm sleeping on a buddy's couch because I'm now couch hopping. And I say, it just came to that point where I got to take a drink. You know, I'm in Virginia. I just got to go rob a 7-Eleven, you know, break the wine fridge. They lock them at 11, I think, you know. So I got to just go in there with a brick and out I go. And whatever happens, happens. And but I hit my knees and I said, "Larry O's higher power, can you please help me? I don't know if I can take one more day of this. You know, I don't think I can take another hour of this. I need a drink." And I went in and I fell asleep. And, you know, and I woke up the next day and there was a little bit of relief in my life. Not a lot, but a little, enough to keep me going for another day. You know, and someone used to talk about, it's darkest before dawn. And I've had that experience a bunch in my sobriety where there just feels like I can't take one more day of this kind of pain. I've hit my threshold. Please, God, can I get a little relief? And the next morning, that little relief comes. And I've come to rely on that. You know, they're like, sobriety is not all, you know, roses and butterflies and puppies, you know. Things happen. And, you know, so I'd fired my sponsor at that time, too. I forgot to mention that because I was resentful that he kicked me out of his house. Right. It's kind of straightforward. But I wound up getting that man, Travis, as my sponsor, who I talked to while I was in rehab. And he's been my temporary sponsor for going on 15 years. We're seeing how it goes, you know. We might see other people. We don't know. But it's worked out so far. And, you know, in that time, Travis got me reading the book. He got me into the steps. I had done a fourth and a fifth step, but I hadn't been rigorously honest. But I got into a fourth and a fifth step, and I put everything down. I put all the secrets, all the sex inventory, all the resentments. Because I didn't know I'd been carrying around 2 garbage bags on my back everywhere I went, you know, that was just destroying all of my relationships, you know, because I'm bringing yesterday's junk into today. And And I got honest with him. And we did my fifth step. He had what I wanted. He had a 95 Z28 Camaro with headers and exhaust. It was an awesome car. And we were doing like 90 miles an hour all the way to Ocean City. And I'm not saying we were by no means like good. We were still trying to get better together. And but when I'd finished, I looked out the window and this sounds so cliche, but the grass was a little greener. The sky was a little bluer. It was a little sunnier out. I was not as wrapped up in me. I had gotten into getting to the meeting early, setting up chairs, making coffee, picking up chairs, trying to talk to people. You know, I didn't have a car, but I could, you know, make a plan to have someone help me pick some guy up and take him to get dinner and, you know, take him to the meeting. And it worked. You know, I stayed sober and started to feel better. But I still had this resentment towards this ex-girlfriend and her new boyfriend that I couldn't get over, you know. And I prayed for them for like 14 months. I'm not proud of that. That's really obsessive. But, you know, I prayed throughout that entire time. I was praying to Larry O's higher power. You know, every day. Larry O's higher power, please help me today. Larry O's higher power, thank you. Thank you for keeping me sober today. And, you know, 6 months later, I started dating someone else. And she went off to Hawaii and came back with gifts and then broke up with me. So, like, I got, like, parting gifts for being dumped. And that didn't feel good, you know. And I called my sponsor and I told him what happened. And he said, you know, what did we do last time? I said, well, we went to more meetings. We reached out our hand. We tried to be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. We made AA the number one priority. He said, let's do it again, you know, and more prayer. I said, okay. And I went on and I did that and I did that and I did that. And then, you know, through experiences, you know, Larry O's higher power somehow became my God. And that, like, blind faith evolved into faith, turned into an absolute, complete, concrete belief. You can try and argue the existence of God with me. I'm not even going to fight back. Because in my life, it's an absolute that Larry O's higher power has taken care of me ever since that day. Through the good, the bad, and the ugly. You know? And unfortunately, I've had it all. I've had the good, the bad, and the ugly. I had wound up meeting another woman, and we wound up getting engaged. And I had a new job that was paying me well. I had more money than I had ever had. I had new car, new golf clubs. I'm going out to eat all the time. You know, life is great at 6 years sober. Yeah. You know, I love it. And because I got everything I wanted. And then it all, you know, it just ended with us. You know, there wasn't anything. It was the right decision. And my job, which was based on the economy, kind of turned. And, you know, so I was struggling. And I had built this life about how it all looks from the outside. Do I look successful? Do I look like I know what I'm doing? Am I saying something really deep and spiritual in the meetings that people are, like, quoting me later, man? You know, like it was all about how it looked. It always had been, you know, and that caused me a lot of financial pain because I was not living. I was not humbly where, you know, I am the same person in every area of my life. It was still about what you thought of me, how it looked. And then when, you know, that relationship ended and, I'd never gone to college and, my sponsor had me doing my eighth step, and I had gone to my dad, and I said, Dad, I owe you all this money. What can I do? And he's like, I don't want your money. Just stay sober. And I was like, cool. You know, I was like, well, I owe it to you. He's like, no, I don't want it. I was like, okay. And then I used to think that, like, amends are an event. It's like a one-night thing that changes everything, right? And it's a great talk from the podium. So I went to my mother and I said, Mom, I was a terrible son. I had done a lot of damage to our family as a whole, where it was not a happy, safe place. And I'm responsible for that. What can I do to make it right? And she said, you can go get a college degree. And I'm like, wait a minute. Hold up. You can't do that in like less than 4 years. Right? Like, this is supposed to be an event. Well, I took that back to my sponsor. And I was like, well, my mom told me to get a college degree. And he said, okay, well, go sign up at the community college to take a class. So I went to the local community college and I signed up to take a math class. And my mom's been a math teacher for over 30 years. And the darndest thing happened that I would go into that math class, and my mom's free period was that 45 minutes right after I got out of my class. And I would call her, and I would tell her what I had learned. And I'm a math nerd from a family of math nerds. My brother's an accountant. Both my parents were math teachers at some point. And like we nerded out over like word problems like at our dining room table. It was weird. I know, but I would talk to her about this, and we just talked, you know, and it was awesome, you know. And then the next semester, I took another class, and in this time, I had gotten a job working for this family. I was 26. I had gotten a job working for this family as a nanny. Because I had to pay my rent if I'm going to go to college, right? Like, my job was commissioned, so, like, it didn't, you know, I need something steady. And and while I'm working for this family and, you know, going to school a little bit, and then I go to my home group on Sunday nights, and at halftime I got a text message that my mom was in the hospital. And I've never once left my home group at halftime. But I did that night with a buddy of mine. I went to the hospital and I saw my mom and my dad, and my mom was like slow. She had a minor stroke, and it was her though, you know, but she was just a little slow to respond. And I talked to her for 10 minutes and I said, I love you. Have a good night. I'll be here tomorrow. And my mother had a massive stroke overnight. And I was back there the next day, and I had to call my brothers and tell them to come into town, and, you know, wound up being a 2-week process, but ultimately my mother did pass away, unfortunately. And it kind of caught me off guard, because I hadn't even dawned on me that my parents were at that point. It just hadn't. It caught me completely by surprise. And so in a 6-month period, my fiance and my mother had both left my life. And I was struggling, because all this female intimacy was gone. And that was the large area of my life. And I'm kind of wheeling from it. And I just, you know, I'm like, all right, I just keep doing what you're doing, is what my sponsor said. So that was going to meetings, going to school, and, you know, and working. And trying to help people and still show up early, still set up the chairs, still be of service however you can. And I did that. And I started going to school full time. And 4 years later, I'm at the Comcast Center at the University of Maryland on graduation day. Sorry. And I text my brother to see, you know, what section are you guys in? I'd love to wave at you. And he's like, we're in section 214. And that had been my mom's classroom number for 20 years. And it hit me like a ton of bricks right in that moment. And I don't believe in coincidences, and I do believe in God. And it had taken 5 years of hard work to make that happen. And 5 years, I haven't done anything for 5 years. I've stayed sober. That's about it. And go to college. That's all I've done in my life. And when I wrote her name down on a sheet of paper, I didn't know that that's what was going to happen. I didn't know that God was going to give me that gift. And you know, and things changed, you know, in my life. That, you know, I remember I called my sponsor one time and I said, Travis, I think I'm a narcissist, that I don't know how to love another human being. I don't know how to choose you over me. I don't think I'm capable of it. And he said, well, let me ask you a question. If I called you from the middle of a back road of North Carolina on my way to visit my parents in Charlotte with a broken down car at 3 a.m, what would you do step by step? I said, I'd get up, I'd use the bathroom, I'd make a pot of coffee, and I'd get in the car and come get you. And he goes, how is that not love? So from that relationship, I've learned to love another human being and be able to say it to them. You know, an amazing thing happened. In my family, the last thing we always say to each other is, I love you. No matter where we are or what we're going on. A lot of that has to do with my mom. You know, you don't know. But it, I do love those people. You know, and I'm going to end with this. My brother, my second brother, called me up and asked me to be the best man in his wedding. And I said, let me get back to you, right? That's not the right answer, by the way. Just like when someone says, I love you, the correct response is, I love you too. That was not the right answer. I called my sponsor, and I said, Travis, Dan just asked me to be the best man. And I've described my brother Dan as the person that installed that button when I was 5 years old, and he still likes to push it from time to time, you know, just to get me, see if it still works. And it does, and I react every time. But I said, Dan just asked me to be the best man at his wedding. And he said, well, you say yes. I was like, are we going to talk about this? He's like, no, we're not. Your job is to shoot up, suit up, show up, and keep your opinion to yourself. You know that with my family. I'm like, okay. So Dan and I go out looking at tuxedos for this wedding. And then we go out to have dinner. And Dan says, you know why I picked you to be the best man at my wedding? And I said, no, but it's none of my business. That's your stuff. My job is to show up and keep my opinion to myself and smile when appropriate, right? And he said, well, I want to tell you. I was like, okay. He goes, you know, I've never in my life seen anyone change their life as much as you have. I've never met anyone that has the ability to accept the unacceptable on a moment's notice. I've never met anyone like that in my life. And my brother is talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and doesn't even know it. That's not me that he's describing in that moment. That is what you people have taught me and how to behave and the tools you've given me to live in my life, which I can't do that. I'm the guy that punches the little brother and goes to the pawn shop with his toys. That's who I am. Not this guy that people seem to like trust and rely on. And it's thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, a sponsorship, the steps, trying to help other people and God. You know? And Alcoholics Anonymous changed my life. I don't deserve this. I don't deserve anything. I'm incapable of the circumstances of my life today. And the main thing is the relationships. It's the people. Yes, materialistic things will ebb and flow. Sometimes they're good. Sometimes they're bad. It's whatever. It's not up to me. But the relationships are the things that have been constant. I'm very fortunate. The first three friends I made in Alcoholics Anonymous are currently celebrating 19 years, 18 years, and 16 years of sobriety. I fell into a group of friends that have carried me. And a sponsor that's coming up on 20 years of sobriety that is carrying me. And a grand sponsor that's coming up on 30 years of sobriety that's carrying me. I just got lucky with the people that are around me. We're going to the meeting and setting up the chairs so it was easy to get in the car and do those things. You know, and I'm very grateful for my life today. And again, thank you for letting me join you guys. I'm really grateful that you asked me to come out here. Thank you, Sam. And that's all I got. Thanks for letting me share.